Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. And this week's show features or includes three guests and one engineer, engineer Michael Umney. And we're going to talk about John Cage, specifically an exhibition called John in a Cage, curated by Christina Ramos, who is here in the studio with us. And it was also curated by Helena Lugo, who is not with us. Two other guests are performers Sarah Rodriguez and Gabriel
Cavallo.
Thank you. And Sarah and Gabriel are musicians and performers who took
composers
who took part in this exhibition, which took place on the 23rd and 24th of January at the Charlton Gallery, Charlton Street, London, Northwest 1, just for 2 days. So that was John in a Cage. First of all, we are going to try and contact one of the other composers, Mr. Richard Melkonian, on the telephone, because he couldn't be here today, so we're going to try and contact him. So, Michael, my trusty engineer, please go ahead. Let's make the call. In the meantime, in the background, we have John Cage's Music of Changes from 1951. But in the meantime, Christina, perhaps you could introduce us and just sort of run us through the show, how it came about.
Yeah, so the reason why it came about was that I was invited to choose one modernist artist and look at his work from a contemporary perspective. So at the time I was doing a great deal of research on John Cage in many of his, I don't know, like in particular on his writings. So it made sense to do it about John Cage.
You're a curator?
Yes.
And how long have you been a curator?
For a year and a half, officially,
okay.
I guess.
So have you done other shows?
I have, yes. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Such as?
I did an interesting one at a place called Valentine's Mansion in Essex that also involved a lot of sonic works. I've done some things at a place called Window Space. I've done something in Barcelona, Spain.
So you're from Spain?
Yes, I am from Spain.
We also curate a project called The Living Room, which basically makes exhibitions in non-art spaces. So I made it in a house, in a furniture shop, and then in a church. And then we invite both artists and musicians, so from a wide variety of the arts, works that relate to our theme or to the space that it's in, so then it becomes more poignant.
Right.
I think Cage would be interested in that.
Yeah.
So is this always sound-based?
It is. The Living Room is all about putting music and visual art in the same place.
Okay, but as a curator, do you sort of tend to focus on sonic and sound things?
I am naturally interested in it, really interested. Not necessarily only on that.
Right.
I always say I'm interested in everything that interests me.
Right.
But I think it's really it's still a debate and a big question to wonder where's the place of music.
Yeah.
Within the contemporary or within the museum or the institution.
Right.
I think that's quite...
Why is the show called John in a Cage? Is that just a play on words or is there some suggestion that he's kind of trapped in something?
Well, that's a really good point, though, because, of course, he is a pun with his name, but at the same time, Cage, for many people, is still really... anarchist figure in the way that you will get some young composers or young musicians or young artists saying, well, this is not what is this, you know, this is not what it's claiming to be, this is not melodic or it's not proper composition. No,
hang on a sec, how are we doing with Richard?
Well, he should be there.
Is he there?
Yeah.
I can hear him. We can hear. Hello, Richard Melkonian. This is William English on Wavelength, and you were just speaking to Michael Umney, also of Resonance 104.4 FM. We have your colleagues here in the studio. Christina, do you want to make contact with Richard?
Hello, Richard.
Hi, Christina. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Sorry, I couldn't be there today, but it's also interesting to kind of have this remote conversation with you.
Indeed, yeah. Well, you're here, you know.
Whereabouts are you, Richard?
I'm in Bermondsey. I'm currently moving into a new place.
You're only about 100 yards away, then.
So. Oh, that's pretty funny, actually.
All right.
Well, I literally just arrived because I'm moving all my things into a new place. Traffic is crazy, so
right.
Just got here, so it's perfect timing, actually, that you called because I was driving before, so that's good.
Oh, yes, don't drive. And use the phone. We get raided otherwise, isn't it? So you are a composer and musician yourself?
Yeah, I'm studying at Guildhall School of Music and Drama, classical composition. But prior to doing that degree, I studied filmmaking and was very interested in visual arts, and I suppose that carried through into my work as a composer.
You're the only one that isn't Latin.
I know. Yeah.
What happened?
I don't know. Maybe I'm sort of dark and dark haired enough to sort of fit in or something.
Oh, okay.
I'm half Armenian, you see, so I don't know.
Right, because everyone else here is Portuguese, Spanish, or Italian.
Yeah. And,
okay. All right, and you took, what was your contribution to John in a Cage?
So I wrote I came up with an idea for a theatrical happening performance piece. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in Cage's ideas about theatre and his work with Cunningham and the happenings that took place at Black Mountain College. And actually, apparently, him and Merce Cunningham came up with this concept of a happening and the idea that anything can be theatre as long as we want it to be theatre. And obviously that led on to crazy implications, Fluxus art and the new realism of the 60s, and it all went out of control from there. But I think they kind of got onto this real interesting idea. And I wanted to revisit that and go back to that and almost transport back into that time period and that aesthetic. As a composer, I kind of work quite closely with my material, and I'm usually very, I use chance processes, but not at all in Cajun ways.
You use what? Sorry, chance processes.
Yeah, I use some chance processes.
Yeah.
And, I allow things to intervene. I use a lot of open score notation. I allow improvisation.
What was your piece like for this particular event?
So what happened was I built these hanging sculptures, which were instruments, so percussion instruments, which were essentially found objects. And I covered the gallery in crumpled pieces of paper, which were small text scores. So they were parts which the audience could open up, read, and carry out the text scores. So it was the piece could be any length, any duration.
Right.
So it was a performance piece that involved improvisation, percussion, and audience members. Yeah.
Okay. Christina has something to say, I think.
Yeah, so as Rita said, there were a lot of elements that we didn't know how it was going to be in the end. Like, say, for example, the participation of the audience or the public. Like, sometimes, artists, they devise these pieces in which there's involvement of the public directly, and you never know what's going to happen until it happens.
Yeah, that was... I was interested in that line, that tension. And I thought it was going to be a lot calmer than it was, but actually everyone just delved into it, and it turned into this wonderful sort of simmering chaos, and it was really interesting.
Yeah,
was everyone's piece happening simultaneously, or did it take part like a formal, one thing ended and another one started?
No, something interesting that happened, and that was a bit worried for me as curator, was that Noble wanted to have a particular set time to perform.
Uh-huh.
everyone.
Oh, apart from Sarah. It says she had a particular time.
I had four performers coming in from the New Music Ensemble that we were involved in, so they had to have a specific time. But no one knew the time, and Christina didn't want to have it on the program notes. So people would just come in the gallery and kind of see what was happening, and then things would just merge, so they weren't advised.
Right.
Yeah, which really created an atmosphere of tension in which everyone was asking what's happening, what's going to happen next, what is going on.
Yeah.
And my answer will be like, well, you know, it's happening already.
Right. And did the gallery had sort of opening hours and closing hours, or were you able to just kind of continue through the night?
We did set those times. Right. In the end, we all need to have some sort of... information.
One thing that happened was it was supposed to be from 4 to 9 p.m. Then my piece started at like 7-ish, but the other piece, we actually said, okay, let's start the last piece at 8, so it runs till 9.
Yeah.
But because my piece was also variable duration, so it could be anything from 10 minutes to like more than an hour, it actually lasted 1 hour and 10 minutes, and it completely ran over the next one.
Okay.
So the gallery had to close later because of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you get a good crowd?
We did. That's the whole thing. And also with Richard Pitts, everyone respond really well. Like, people were there responding to everything that was happening, to the environment, taking part on it. It was really interesting in many, many ways. I hope we could discuss those today.
Yeah, I think people like to be involved in the pieces. I think everyone is very engaged with Richard's piece.
Yeah.
Gabrielle?
Yes. From a perspective, as mainly a performer for the music ensemble and the for Sarah's piece, also being interested in like Cage's aesthetics and experiments like from the 60s and 70s, one of the most interesting thing of John in a Cage event was the compenetration of the artworks one inside the other. Also because Sarah's piece was as far as I know, right, Sarah, I was intended to pass, to turn from being a performance piece, so with a duration in time, to be like live installation, like an actual installation of the result of the piece. And also for other pieces, so for instance, during our performances, we musicians were performers were also asked to engage with the spaces, so we also engaged with the other artworks and the other happenings and performances that happened before and get crystallized, let's say, into a fixed solid object around the space, and it was like compenetrating into the following artwork, following performance. And this,
I have some samples actually.
Do we still have Richard on the line?
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I'm listening.
He's there.
So okay. Later on, I can show how actually there's.
Indeed, we can.
In
play
my piece,
some of those,
it interacts with Richard's piece, which is funny.
Does it?
The
okay.
Wind chime thing.
Well,
I'll show it later.
Should we play a bit of Richard's piece? Of something that. Is that.
Yeah, that would be good, and then perhaps Richard can comment.
How long is this?
Is this the one that's called Charlton Happening?
Charlton Happening, that's right.
That's
that was the title.
2 minutes and 20 seconds.
Okay.
Perhaps we could do an excerpt.
Should we play that? Or an excerpt? Oh, yeah, we'll play a minute and talk over the other.
Just to not get Richard on the line.
Okay, Richard, we're going to play your piece now.
Great.
Just fading it down a bit.
Sure.
Do you want to say anything about this? I mean, the voices in the background, are they people just in the gallery or?
Yeah, they're people in the gallery reading pieces of text that are that they pick up, which are so the text scores that they pick up will either instruct them to play the percussive objects around them or read out various pieces of text.
Right. So they're following sort of instructions then on the.
Yeah,
on the
piece.
Right. Is it inspired by Cage? It's not a score by Cage as such.
No. Well, the texts are a selection of texts from some of his writing. So very short musings, short Zen stories, short stories about him going and, you know, being interested in a particular kind of species of mushroom, for example.
Right.
It's kind of a little you know, deconstruction of Cage's world, and then we're reading out these pieces of text. And there's only about four or five of the texts that are copied multiple times. So what happens in performance is there are multiple people reading out the same text, but at different points.
Okay. And what about the percussion? Are the people, they are playing the percussion themselves within the gallery, so that it's participation of the audience, as it were?
Yeah. All that percussive sound you heard was audience members playing either soft sounds, short sounds, loud sounds, or quiet sounds.
Right, yeah. Right.
And also the sound, no, Richard? The background sound that you can hear throughout.
Yeah, so I needed a way to mark the beginning and the end of the piece. So I used these drones of sine tones to kind of be the canvas of, I suppose, the space and time of that the performance would last in.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to frame that was to use these drones. And each pitch of the drone is derived from the name John Cage. So J being the 10th letter of the alphabet, and then going up the chromatic scale from C, and you get to B flat. So I went through his name like that and just chose all the pitches, and it actually made a really wonderful sound, actually, a wonderful chord.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So that was the continuous drones that you have, which added a certain level of tension, but yeah, it was interesting. It was interesting.
Hmm. Okay. Is that the end of that piece?
Yes.
Yeah, so that piece is finished. Yes, you were saying about the mushrooms. Of course, he was a strict... I remember I did see him in London a couple of times, John Cage, and on one occasion he was outside a macrobiotic restaurant on Old Street, which is no longer there, because I think he always used to insist on eating sort of brown rice and very pure food. I think he was very suspicious of ordinary restaurants that he might get food poisoning or something. But
yeah, he had quite a strict diet. But the irony of that is that there are some people wonder whether his death was attributed to his extreme diet.
His death? Really?
Yeah, because several times he went into hospital due to mushroom poisoning.
Oh, the mushrooms. Oh, right, okay. Oh, yeah, that's requires great skill, doesn't it, to choose the right ones?
Yeah.
He confused them.
So... And you served sautéed mushrooms at this gallery, I think.
We did, yeah. On that line I was going to say.
Has everyone recovered? Are they
good? Yeah, they're good.
No, Nina made them.
Yeah, everyone is fine. I made some. I cooked some with just garlic and onions. And
okay. But any? Yeah. Did you choose very specific mushrooms?
No, I
didn't. Just mushrooms.
We were little shot glasses.
I just bought
Yeah, we decided to deviate from Cage and orthodoxy.
Right.
Not to intoxicate anyone.
No. All right.
We did think about it, though. We did think about some sort of, you know, mushrooms. But
All right. We were saying this business about John in a cage. You were going to expand on that to some degree. Or is that just...
Yeah,
it's just a play on words, or do you feel that he sort of painted himself into a corner somewhat with his?
Yeah, I think it will be interesting to open here a bit of debate of some conversations we had before, also with Richard, in which it seems that John Cage is more relevant to fine art, or you know, in visual art, even though he was a musician or his formation was as a musician,
right.
It seems that his figure was more relevant for art people than for music people.
Yeah, there was a book called where someone talked about Duchamp, Cage and I think it's Rauschenberg.
Mm. Probably, yeah.
They were the three of them together, because I think they did collaborate on something.
Yeah.
Rauschenberg was also Cage's partner, I think, for a while.
Oh, right.
Yeah, for a while, I think.
Okay. So there's probably more of a connection with the visual arts than, say, somebody like Steve Reich or somebody.
Definitely.
You're welcome to join in, Michael, if you have
I'm not there yet.
You're not there.
I think, actually, if I'm not wrong, he was interested in doing more things related to visual art, but I think once, because he was taught by Schoenberg, and he said, I told Schoenberg that I will dedicate my life to music, because that was the only way. Schoenberg said, I'll teach you, but you have to dedicate your life to this. So once he started doing the collages and the prints at Black Mountain College, he said, okay, I'm going to do this 2 weeks during summer every year, but so he wouldn't do it for longer, because then it means that he, you know, have to deviate his career, and I think he stuck very much to music in that sense.
Right. Mm-hmm. And do you all have a kind of a fine art background? Have you come to music from art?
I studied fine art before, and then I thought, actually, I really want to study music, so I'm at Goldsmiths in my final year as well, studying composition.
Right.
But I think it's really interesting, because when you do study art, then you do look at music in a different way. You question things. I'm not saying that other people don't question things, but it is kind of a different way of considering. So you don't look as in so much like, how can I put these pictures together, but what do they actually do to each other? Or what is this, you know, what does this bottle do when it's next to a note that's being put that way? You know, it's kind of, you consider the world as a whole instead of just a kind of more refined idea of what music can be.
I think he did, Cage did drawings as well, didn't he? Did he do some things on sort of edible paper? I think it was some edible rice paper that you could sort of...
I think he used a lot of rice paper, perhaps because of his diet. I don't know.
Right.
Relation to it at all.
There was an exhibition also, Cage's drawings.
Jeremy Della curated an exhibition.
So the Black Mountain College.
A few years ago. I can't remember where, but I think it was in Baltic, and then Travis.
We should probably name the other contributors to the show. There were the exhibition John in a Cage, which took place on 23rd to 24th of January at the Chalton Gallery, included Alexandra Baybutt and David Somlow, Patrick Coyle, Richard Melkonian, who is still on the line, patiently waiting, Sarah Rodriguez, who is here in the studio, Himali Singh Soin.
Yes, that's right.
And Gabrielle Cavallo.
Yes.
Who isn't actually mentioned on this list.
One of the performers.
Okay. One of the performers. Right. The three musicians.
He's on the floor plan.
He's on the program. He was mentioned.
You're on the floor plan. And I should mention David Price. David Price, who's actually been on this program two or three times with his ongoing narrative. And hopefully he will come back sometime.
Yeah. And who was the artist that gave the note of colour to the exhibition?
Uh-huh.
Because formally speaking, we had five of these wonderful prints David is developing and are based on the album cover of Genesis, the band Genesis.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Okay. Of course. Michael is nodding knowingly.
I just think of that one with all the different, the sting in the tail, whatever it's called.
I'm not familiar with any Genesis covers. No, no.
Okay. Yes.
I'm not going to mention Phil Collins. Okay. All right.
The album, the name of the album, just for, you know, information note, is ABACAB, originally designed by Bill Smith. So it's like this. Uh-huh. Primary colours juxtapose one on top of the other, and then they start playing with them digitally and archiving a lot of information, also using all the works by him, juxtaposing all these elements one on top of each other.
Yep.
And then the frame on a, is it 12-inch record frames? You know, there's like a, this is like a set for...
The size of a long playing record.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So they were framed with those. And those were the only works that were hanging on the walls. Which, you know, for me as a curator, it was slightly difficult to put together this, because, you know, it is a mixture of peaceful things and sounds.
Yeah.
But you want everything to come together.
Which it did.
Why was the exhibition so short? I mean, could it not have... was that just the practicality of it? I mean, it could have made it difficult for some people to
definitely
get through.
Definitely, yeah. But I guess it was practicalities of the gallery.
Right.
But at the same time, we thought it would be good to just, like, keep it quite condensed and intense and content in the same place. So it was like...
Will it move on? Will it appear somewhere else or never again?
Who knows?
Okay.
I might ask a quick question.
Yes, Michael Umney.
Curating sound art in a gallery space.
Yes.
William might remember 5 years ago the Resonances gallery show, sound art gallery show.
Gone
with the Wind, which was at Raven Row.
Yes, indeed.
And one of the things I remember about that was that... Resonance called for open submissions of sound art pieces from students from like all of the sound art teaching universities in London.
Nice.
And then they all turned up. These pieces turned up. And of course, there was no way to display them in Raven Row, which is a Georgian townhouse.
Yeah.
So, or no way to display them as individual pieces. So in this room right at the top of the building, they just all got put in this one room.
Yeah. Everything.
And there was this amazing room of cacophony so it was impossible to kind of...
Oh, well.
And it must have been, I don't know how the artists would have felt about that, but it did... It meant that you experienced those pieces in a completely different way because those curatorial decisions have been forced by the space. And it's very rare that you'd be putting visual art in a space where you'd have to, like... jam all the pictures into one corner. Do you think that it changes the way that you... changes the work, the nature of the work, that the gallery space...
You mean how do you display it?
The gallery space ends up having an effect on the work because the work is muted.
Definitely.
Is that noise in the background?
That's the telephone.
It's him on the telephone.
Yeah, he might have got bored.
Hello, Richard.
Sorry.
Oh, there he is.
It's okay.
Did you fall asleep?
You're eating mushrooms there or something. Sorry. We'll get back to the... Okay, continue with the question.
Of course. I mean, think about...
Heavy breathing.
Silence Richard until we want him back.
Richard, what are you doing?
I'm just moving some objects around.
No, Richard. You're being
featured. It's a performance. Yeah.
I think maybe Richard...
Take it as ambient sound.
Just moving house.
Okay, perhaps we could do like one quick question with Richard
and then we can let him move in, whatever it is he's doing.
Movement of objects.
Yeah.
So
that's fine.
So there's this beautiful interview that you can take on YouTube, produced by Allegri Film. They did with John Cage, and they asked him 19 questions, and they kind of like give him a time to answer.
Okay.
So I'd like to try doing the same thing today, right now, here.
Oh, wow.
Well, in the spirit of improvisation, you know?
Yeah. Well, this is really in a true Acadian interview, then, but in the spirit of Cage. But yeah, okay.
Definitely. Shall we try it?
Yeah.
We'll come back to Michael's question afterwards.
Yeah. Okay. So I've got a timer here on my phone. So, how does this work? Okay, so...
What's the process? What's taking place here? What are we doing?
Richard.
Yeah.
This is going to be 9 seconds on indeterminacy.
Okay.
So that's indeterminacy.
To go where you've never been.
Okay.
Is that it? Are we finished?
Yeah,
9 seconds done.
I interrupted it, didn't I? Did I ruin the moment?
Maybe I wasn't counting.
No, that's welcome to that. Like,
all right,
that's outside.
Richard, we're going to let you get back to moving objects. So thank you very much for joining in, and you can hang up now. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Bye bye then.
Bye.
Bye. Have a good day.
Bye, Richard.
Okay, so can you remember Michael's question?
Yeah, so I think Michael's question was whether a gallery space changed the way you display work of art
or
sound.
Yeah, you change the art to fit in the gallery space.
Definitely, though. I mean, an exhibition is that. An exhibition is a space. is the showing or the display of a number of works within a space.
But I guess I'm thinking particularly about sound art.
Sound
if you're
art.
Going to design a gallery for sound art, maybe it would be like 50 small soundproofed rooms.
Or
sound art gets displayed in gallery spaces that were like designed for visual art.
I guess it depends what's your intention, you know? Like, one thing I always think about is whether works should collide with each other, sounds colliding with each other. That can be really interesting, but perhaps you'll get an artist saying, you know, I want my sound piece to be here. Just it, you know?
So there's a risk of compromise, maybe, if someone's work is somehow... I mean, especially with things like volume, where someone could get overwhelmed by whatever was next to it.
Definitely. So, but my experience tells me that what is interesting about working with sound art is when things like that happen, when sounds collide incidentally, you know, when you're in a room and you're listening to something, but then there's another sound far away, but you're getting that as well.
Right.
The result of that, I think, is very interesting. How, you're as an artist, you produce a lot of like sound works, and how do you feel about it? Will you leave the decision to a curator? Or
no? No, I think it's right. I think it's always a compromise between what you want from the piece, what the piece is intended to do. Is it intended to just, you know, speak solely for the audience? Is it open to the things that happen around them? But I think, for example, in this piece that I created, it's called Notes on Space and Time. So the idea is actually to do a mapping of the environment, so of the space and time that it happens in. And so I really wanted to interact with the other works. I mean, Christina said, you know, don't worry, there's not going to be another sound work happening on top of it. Mm-hmm. Which is always good because, you know, people need to focus their attention somehow on what is happening, or else it's just craziness. But but it is interesting how, for example, Richard had these wind chimes, which he made with the metal objects that also, that you heard them in the piece before. And at one point, Gabriele actually goes, I don't know if I can explain a bit more.
Of course, go ahead.
So yes, I had like, eight different tasks. So there's four performers sitting on a table. I'm just going to name the performers and say hi. Mm-hmm. So it's Roxanne Albayati on cello, Eva Hillier on violin, Nicole Trotman on flute, and Gabrielle in clarinet. So it's for any instrumentation, but they have to be either wind or strings, basically. And so they're sitting around a table and they have a various set of instructions. And it's devised, so there's a macro structure and they have eight tasks to be completed. And so one the task that actually related to Richard's piece was the one that Gabriele picked up, and it said, find a feature inside the room, then go there, record it, perform it, record it with your phone, bring it back to the table, and then perform it again on your phone. And so actually, every player, when sitting on the table, has a little matrix sheet, which John Cage also used to use before he introduced the I Ching as a chance operation to his work. And so they select pitches, so they create a 12-series tone row, and is then inserted into a matrix generator. So you have a little table of, say, like squares, right? And then they do a floor plan of the space of the gallery. So Charlton Gallery was drawn as a floor plan. And then you locate where the table was inside that space and where the performers were sitting. So say when Gabriele went to look for a feature inside the gallery, so he found Richard's piece, the other players had to look at where he was going and then write on their sheet of paper in relation to the floor plan they've made of the gallery where Gabriele was. Mm-hmm. And so they circle that. And so that will be a pitch because all the little tables filled up with little pitches that have been created by the matrix sheet. And so they start playing that pitch, each one of them. But obviously, all the floor plans are different because they have a different perspective of the room as to where they're sitting. And so I don't know if we could play a little bit of that one. it's called Feature Inside Space.
Yeah, is that feature inside space merged?
Yeah, so...
yeah, I got a question for you later on. Yeah.
Okay, I'll play that down.
he comes back to the table and the other players start playing the pictures of where he was, and then he comes back to the table with his phone, having had the recording of what he played, and then he performs it at the table with his phone.
That was percussion, though, wasn't it?
That was
part of Richard's work before, which had become an installation. So I picked up the ticket, with instruction, I considered that as a feature of the room. So I performed the installation before.
Right.
So then you can hear it.
That's a recording.
That's a recording. So the other instruments have to play, so they have to copy what the object is doing itself, so the sound. So then there are various parameters. There's one task that says find an object inside the room, bring it to the table and perform it, so he's physically performing that object. And another task says find an object outside the room, so the performer has to go outside and find something, then bring it back. And then there are ones where they actually have to go with their phone and record the sound, so when they bring it back to the table, it's not the actual object, but just the sound of it being performed. And then there's various dynamics that can be selected at random as well.
Right.
So it'd be increasing dynamic, decreasing, stabilize. There's one that has a zero, it means silence. So that's a little.
All of these ideas are interpretations of what Cage might have done, or you're in the spirit of Cage.
It's very much in the spirit of Cage in the sense of chance operations.
Right.
Where I have like a macro structure, but then it's determined by people picking things at random, but then it is also then left down to the performers to go and find the objects, but they need to be around the space.
What do you think Cage would have thought of phones in his pieces?
Well, he used electronic devices before, so I think I think it's so a further step away from the actual object, just retaining its sound. So I think it's a way of recording sounds, which I think he'd approved.
Okay.
I think in a way that he does these chances, but for example, music of changes, then everything is actually fully notated. Mm-hmm. So he uses the I Ching, but then that is transformed to a score that is not actually indeterminate, but it's written down. Whereas this, I wanted to leave. So every time it is performed, it will dictate what the space had and the time that it was performed at. So I don't actually know what's going to happen. So I wanted to leave as much as open as possible. And so each task as well just has the length of the duration. Say it was 5:53 at the time the task was started, so they just performed that task for 3 minutes.
Right.
Or so it could be less or more.
There's some mention of radios located in the gallery. Mm-hmm.
Yes. We were lucky enough to borrow three really nice and vintage radios, and we had those around the gallery. We kind of invited people.
When you say vintage, how vintage?
How vintage?
How old?
Like from, I don't know, like
2001?
No. I think like sort of 60s actually.
Oh right,
real old radios.
Okay. So
with wonderful sounds.
So what were they tuned into?
Whatever people wanted to. So they were there in the spirit of John Cage as well.
Yeah. So would they have been so people could adjust the radio themselves in the gallery?
Yeah,
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that will be a sort of sound that will create to happen in the meantime performance as well.
Right.
Activated.
Okay.
So there were this a continuous
Gabriel,
sound.
I was saying that this reminds also like of Imaginary Landscape Number 4.
Oh,
like random operation on like live radios with like radio programs that could do it right now while they're listening to us actually.
Go on.
I was going to say there is a bit that Gabriella actually performs a bit of a sculpture that made by Patrick Coyle, which also has text. I have it there actually. Because it's another piece being read, which is actually interesting because I think a lot of people, for example, I didn't read the whole text that was there, maybe because I was stressed out about my piece. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that then actually people are kind of forced or they have to listen to the text of the other piece, even if they haven't read it.
So we had this piece by Patrick Coyle, who works a lot with text and words and how words are written and written, things like that. So he does a lot of performance. He couldn't perform for the occasion because he's now based in New York. So it was slightly difficult to be there physically.
Should we refer somewhat to silence maybe now? Because we were speaking about that earlier.
I had a question.
We should do, okay. And I want to make a comment on regarding Sarah's performance on this, which I thought was really interesting.
It'll probably show up here in the...
I only had like a question to ask Sarah actually about her piece, if I can add it. Like, since I think one of the main sources for inspiration for you was the music of changes that we were playing before, and also like this idea of reproducing somehow the process and exhibiting in this case the process of through which Cage derived like Matrix and all the things. I wanted to ask you, like, because in the music of changes, Cage's when he matches the sounds and sounds events to the Chinese character, like not really Chinese characters, but yeah, to the hexagrams or the I Ching, he basically puts silence as part of that. So basically, when he extracts like odd numbers tickets, those would mean silence. So basically, like in the determination of the row and the matrix of the pitches, there are some blank ones which are basically silent. Well, as a performer doing your piece, when we determined the matrix, the matrix was all full.
Yeah.
So there was no blank spaces. I will just ask if you, I mean, you thought of that, or was like you decided to put the silence as the dynamics, and so.
Yeah. So so the matrix, everything's mapped out, so everything's the same somehow because the space is not empty. So everything, you know. Ooh. So all the pitches are related to some space, but in the dynamics there are six dynamics, so they're variable in so one will come after the other, but the process will be random. So there's one, as I said, the 0-1, which is silence. So say if a task is performed for 9 minutes, there will be about a minute of silence if all the tasks are divided into the total duration. And so it's nice because when they were performing these objects and things, sometimes they would just stand still for a bit and you wouldn't do anything, so you would just hear the environment itself. And because the piece took so long, people actually wandered out and in the gallery. So they couldn't speak inside the gallery, so they went outside. So when people were silent, as the performance went on, you could actually hear people speaking outside, laughing, all these things. So they were actually taking part in the performance without knowing. And then also there was...
Was there a set time when you said, now we're going to perform silence? Within the gallery.
So every task had to go through these durations.
Yeah.
So it was a duration which said, dynamics. So it would be like increase in dynamics for some time. And then they would pick another paper. It might say, now do a decrescendo. Now do, just continue in the same dynamics. And then there would be one which said 0, and that would be silence. Uh-huh. So that might be in the middle of the performance.
Yeah, that makes
that
sense.
Was, yeah.
No,
and also there, I wanted to show just two snippets. One would be the Patrick Coyle being performed by Gabrielli, and then I would want to show another, which one of the tasks was find a person inside the room, bring it to the table, and perform it. So actually,
find a person.
Find a person, yeah,
and perform it.
There's a performer person. That's the sound bit. And actually, the person looked at the papers and was like, "Oh wait, is this meant to be?" And he just kind of speaks about silence a bit and. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know if you want to...
So is this the track called Performer Person?
Yeah, Performer Person. Performer Person.
Yes, this is silence. I should not be speaking right now.
Louder, 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 louder
was really good.
Okay.
Something I thought from Sarah's performance was really, really interesting is that the very beginning of the performance, it took so long for the performers to set up everything, mm-hmm. like to set up the notes and the draw floor plan, everything. Mm. There were a lot of silence there. Mm-hmm.
Right.
There were a lot of people just waiting for them
and
to start performing.
You could hear pencils and just...
Well, yeah. that's the whole thing that Kate used to say, you know, that was why he's so important, is that he said there's nothing like silence. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is to stop for mm-hmm. a minute and be aware of what we have around us. Then we'll discover a lot of sounds
mm-hmm. right.
and therefore things we don't expect. And I thought that was something really interesting from Sarah's performance that really made me think on John Cage's credo of silence and his silent piece and things like that. And also the durational element of it. Like as Sarah said, it went on for like an hour mm-hmm. or something. And, you know, people got bored. They just wanted to go for a cigarette or go back on stuff. But it gave it a low enough time for whoever wanted to really get into the piece.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we still think about music and sounds and something that needs to be fast and boom. But this one was more like long.
I think it was interesting because people come to an exhibition of John Cage, but I think also because of the name of John Cage. So, wow, yeah, let's see what's happening. But actually, do they relate? You know, how much have you thought about the work of John Cage, what he wanted for music, for people to really tune into the to the world, to their life, their living, this kind of thing. So it was interesting to see how... when an object is being performed and then people are like, okay, cool. And then it goes on for 8 minutes and then it's like, okay. And then people start to get bored and they're like, okay, I know what this is. It's just an object being performed. And they kind of leave.
Uh-huh.
And then to have that silence and then they become the work and they become these participants which decided not to participate, but they're part of the silence. And so I kind of like that.
Yeah, I think there was, we got to a very interesting point because I think, I've been studying John Cage for a long time in life, and I think there's a big misunderstanding shared by many people actually about the silent piece and silent pieces, because he wrote more than one. I've always found it a very assertive piece, actually. And I think Sarah's piece, the idea of using silence not in the in the row, in the matrix, but rather as a dynamic, so saying basically, if you have a recording in your hands or an object or an instrument or whatever, don't play it. That's exactly what Cage does. It's interesting. Of course, Cage meant also to pay attention to the environment sound.
It's usually called 4 minutes, 33 seconds, isn't it? Mm,
the silent piece, yeah.
You were saying that that's sort of a mistaken title for it, because it's... I mean, the score, there is a score such as it is.
There are four scores.
4:33.
There are four different scores.
Okay.
Yeah, about that, like, it's not really a wrong title. And one of the main scores of the piece, Cage doesn't specify the duration of the piece. It just says that it has to be divided into three parts for any instrument. But this is the point. He says any instrument, so at least one instrument must be there. It's not just listening to random sounds in the round.
Yeah,
there must be the silence of one instrument. And he basically says that every time the piece is performed, it has to last for a certain amount of time, which will become at the end the title of the piece. And the first performance by David Tudor in Woodstock in October 52 was like for 4:33.
Right.
And the reason about 4:33 does is like kind of a big myth and a legend.
When you say it has to be, there has to be an instrument as such. Does there of necessity have to be a performer too?
Well, okay, this is. I think there's a big debate about that.
Does a tree make sound if there was no one around to listen to it?
Yeah, that's coins. That's coins. Same question. Well, I mean, I think there's a big debate about that. Like, for instance, when I was in Italy university. I remember I was in a class once, a contemporary art class, and it was the lecturer saying that basically now we're gonna have here like Cage's 4:33, and he just kept being silent for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, and I would not I would personally not consider that a good performance of the piece. Yeah. I think this is a real point. Like, there is something theatrical. There is something. There's a kind of a pantomime also of the musical performance. He decided to just divide it into three movements, which
he
is like the classical sonata.
Right.
He doesn't say piano. Cage says instruments.
Okay.
Could be an orchestra. Could be.
So you couldn't just have an empty room with a piano in it and say this is an indefinite piece. The person has to sit at the piano.
I think. Okay. The thing is that I think it could be effective,
that's a
but
very
I think
good question.
There's a big part of Cage who's very ironical. Like he's always trying to escape the categorization.
Yeah, that's true.
And there's a lot of irony in that. And I remember I was speaking to an Italian musicologist once, and he defined. He told me that he found 4:33 hilarious because, like, the idea of this. Classical pianist, very classical pianist, standing there, for three movements, like a classical sonata, but just staying silent. He described it as a metaphysical Buster Keaton. It was this kind of pantomime.
Right.
I think it does not much justice to Cage, just to reduce it to the philosophical part of it.
Hmm. But didn't David Tudor have to raise the lid and then close it at the end or something? Is there some sort of does the suggestion that he is going to do something with the instrument, but then says right, no more?
The suggestion is that the performer or the performers must do something to make clear that. There is a distinction between the movements, but Cage doesn't specify what. For instance, I remember I saw a performance in Siena by clarinet and piano of John Cage's 4:33, and the pianist didn't move the lid.
Okay. There
was just a clarinet player doing the attack for a movement, so it was and I understood that.
All right.
So
you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and we've had some contributors to John in a Cage, an exhibition which took place on the 23rd to the 24th of January at the Charlton Gallery, curated by Christina Ramos and Helena Lugo. And today's guests were Sarah Rodriguez and Gabrielle Cavallo. And on the telephone, we had Richard Malconian, and assisting me was Michael Umney, who's still assisting me silently.
That's part of the assistance.
Yeah,
part of the assistance is the best day.
Exactly. So,
omnipresent.
Do you want to say anything else? What's on in the future? What are you doing next?
Got an exhibition this month, actually.
Oh, and we should say something. There is something about a discussion will be held in the forthcoming weeks at Goldsmiths College.
Yeah, we haven't got a date for it yet.
Ah.
But we wanted to have the exhibition happening first.
Right.
And then
it be announced somewhere?
Yes, it will be announced on the website of the gallery. That's charltongallery.com.
The Charlton Gallery.
Charlton Gallery, yes.
Right.
All
right.
And we'll keep it there. I'd like to quickly read something. I made a little text for the leaflet. I just put some of the text together. And just because we are on the radio, there's this nice thing that Gertrude Stein, French writer, wrote in one of her novels, say something like, sometimes they just sit. Sometimes one turns on a radio and they listen to music or to the news, but they don't care about the actual news, just that the radio is issuing a steady sound whose particulars they do not have to follow to understand what the radio is actually telling them. Life is being lived. No need to be a part of it as long as you know it's streaming.
Ah. Very nice. Was that Gertrude Stein?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
When was that written? When did she?
I'm not very sure. I haven't got enough.
No, don't worry. What's it called? What's it just a sort of. It's
just like a paragraph from one of her novels. It's probably from The Three Lives.
Yes. Okay. Right.
Is that right?
Three lives.
Yeah.
All right.
There.
Well, we will play out with Music of Changes by John Cage.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank
you. Thank you all for coming in. Thank you.
Kristen Wolf once just came to us and in the end everything we do becomes melodic. So it was like bloody scared of that.